Hello, Mike.
What is going on, pal? Right on time. I like that. Military precision.
I figured I'd had to if I'm dealing with someone in New York.
You got me up very early to do this. That's how excited I am. You ready to roll, bro?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been up for a while. You sent me the link some time ago. So you must have started real early.
I got up, went for a little run this morning, and now to interview the famous Thor Pederson, author, traveler, father, husband. Am I missing anything?
No, that sounds about right. I mean, award-winning traveler and best-selling author.
Okay,
So
okay.
you can add
Where you calling me
that.
from?
I'm in Copenhagen, Denmark, the Grand Kingdom of Denmark in the high north of Europe.
I've been to your beautiful country numerous times. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of it. What's that open face sandwich on rye bread, with the food on top of it? Some fish, some stuff. What's that called?
Well, generally we say it's pålegg, so it'd be smørrebrød.
Yes,
It
yes.
could be,
Oh, I remember in your book you said you missed milk the most, which was ironic, but what food did you miss? You're away, you're in Africa, South America, South Pacific. What food did you like? Okay, I need some good food right now back home. What'd you miss the most?
Well, none of it really, because the thing is. The Danish cuisine we in Denmark, we've adapted everything around the world. If you want sushi, you got it. You want pasta, you've got it. You want tacos, no worries. So, what the heck is Danish food these days? And you go around the world, you get all of that stuff. So, if I was really craving spaghetti, then I could just go out and get it, you know. And besides, these countries around the world have evolved over millennia, right? And nobody enjoys bad food. There is no culture, there is no country that aims to have the worst food in the world. Everyone over millennia has worked out which animals to eat and which plants you can throw into it, spices, all this kind of stuff, how long you barbecue it, grill it, cook it, just lay it under the sun, whatever. So they have worked out around the world, no matter where you go, how to get the best out of what they have. And that means you get great food everywhere around the world.
They got that down pat. That's one thing they locked down, right?
I'd say so. Yeah, food is a big topic around this planet. You're having breakfast talking about what we're going to have for lunch. People love food.
Well, nothing relates you more to people than when you meet someone. Oh, I was in your country. You know what I ate? Their eyes light up. They don't want to hear that you saw the Statue of Liberty or the Eiffel Tower. They're like, oh my God, you ate our food. That's the instant connection.
That was in New York. I had a hot dog. Did you? A hot dog? Oh, you're
Bro,
kidding.
raise. I was humble enough to that you sent me a book, The Impossible Journey, an incredible voyage through every country in the world without flying. First of all, congratulations. Congratulations on being a best-selling author.
Thank
How's
you.
the feedback been on the book? Reviews are through the roof. Do you check the reviews still?
I do. I'm fragile, I bruise easily, and I have to go and check and see that it hasn't flipped upside down. You release a book and you're hopefully happy with what you release, and you don't know if how the audience is going to take to it. You don't know if it's a niche kind of book. I still don't know, but I'd say generally, they do 1 to 5 in star ratings, and it has an overwhelming amount of 5-star reviews compared to any of the others. Then it's 4, then it's a few threes, and then almost no 2s and 1s. But then I'm human, so you go and you have a look at that 1 star, like, who
That's all
gave
we
me
care
one
about.
star?
That's all
Why
we care about.
did they give me 1 star? And I get it, because there are travel books out there, and I think what people have come to assimilate with a travel book is someone goes into the world and they describe cultures and people and encounters. And I think a lot of them might be, I haven't read a lot, so I'm guessing, but I think a lot of them might be funny. And the anecdotes about how you misunderstand a culture and then ha ha ha, and this happened and this kind of stuff. That's not what my book is. My book is the story of how I set out with great ambition, highly naive, in 2013, and came home almost a decade later, and what that took from me and what it gave. Yeah, so it's a different kind of book. And if you're expecting that, it's a more serious book, I'd say. I don't know. You read it. What would you say?
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word niche, because on the surface, a traveling book does seem very niche. You know, there aren't many who visited or who want to visit Somalia, Turkmenistan, Nauru, Kiribati, Somalia. Your book was the polar opposite of a travel book. I love traveling, of course, one of my biggest obsessions. So I'll read a couple of travel books. And I mean this as a compliment. Your book was uncomfortably honest. You know, you talked about being bullied, maybe having a slower learning capacity. Of course, your complicated relationship with your mother and father. When you decided to write this book, was that initially like, hey, that's what I'm going to do? Because Thor, I'll be honest, a few of the travel books I've read, it's like, bro, I was partying in Prague. I got destroyed at a pub crawl, slept with a 9. Then I was in Brazil with the hottest girls. Yours went straight to, hey, here's my complicated relationship. Did you know right away you wanted to write a book on that level, like being so open?
I knew I was going to be honest. For the better part of that entire project, so the better part of almost 10 years, I felt like this two-faced kind of relation to social media, where I wanted to give every country in the world a chance, you know, to shine under the sun. And I was looking for positives. And at the same time, I couldn't badmouth immigration or dictatorships or anyone that was working against me and my goal of getting my paperwork or getting on a ship. And this, so, you know, I had to keep it a kind of positive and friction-free, at least until the point where I crossed the finish line. And then, you know, it's up to me if I want to tell the true story. Because I felt I only told part of the true story. And what I wanted to go with this book is I wanted people to know this was no holiday, that this was hard work, and there's a reason why this had never been done before and why it still hasn't been done. It's complicated. It relies on luck. It relies tremendously on people. I mean, the people you meet around the world, if they're not willing to help you, you're going nowhere. You're facing the highest wall you ever have to climb. So then, you know, the stuff that you referenced about my childhood and family relations, this came afterwards. I was speaking to the publisher and the editor, and they're going like, we have to put in the why. You know, you went out and did this, but why? People, they want to know, What caused it? You know, were you abandoned as a child and you were seeking something? Like, what's going on? What happened? And I tried to dive into my childhood, and which I think was pretty decent childhood. You know, most of the time felt safe. You know, I had both my parents growing up. Not everybody has that, and meals and love and friends and this kind of stuff. But there were perhaps certain things that pushed me to go out and do something abnormal.
Speaking of the book, have you seen anyone reading it in public yet?
No, I have not. So the thing is, it's not published in Denmark. And so you can't walk into a bookstore in Denmark and get it. You can buy it online through a sort of online book bookstore in Denmark. The book was published in English. And then they released it. My publisher released it across the UK and Australia and New Zealand, and then it came out in German.
Oh,
where it's doing really well in Germany. That is Germany. That's why it's a bestseller, because the Germans, they really love it. Thank you, Germany.
Hell yeah.
So we're signing with a Czech publisher, so it'll come out in Czech, and the Arabic rights have just been sold. And at this point, there hasn't been much interest in Denmark yet. So we'll have to see. But I am talking to a Danish publisher that's interested. Now we just kind of negotiate the terms.
What's one thing writing the book that you're like, oh, I didn't know that I was going to face this hurdle writing this book? What's one thing that really surprised you?
The amount of work. I mean, the people, they tell you. It is that classic difference between what people they think successes and what it actually takes to accomplish it. It's the Usain Bolt, you know, that's one of the key examples. The man, he runs for 10 seconds and he's world famous, and that's all people see. They don't see the 20 years leading up to that, you know, getting up early in the morning, not drinking alcohol, not doing all the bad stuff, just staying on track, staying determined, and then working your way towards those 10 seconds. So my book is not that extreme. Of course, it's just a book. The world is full of books. But I mean, you grow up with books, you go to school, you go, the books are all around us, maybe less so today. But I don't think people, they really realize what goes into producing a book until you try doing it yourself. And something that's really, really hard is that you think everything should go into the book, but you need to cut. It has to be leaner, you know, you have to cut stuff away. And then when you talk to people that are far more experienced than you, and you know they know better, but in that instance, you feel like you know that they should listen to you, but you know you should be listening to them. And they go, I understand this is a great story, but you kind of told that story with a different narrative 2 years earlier into the book, and so maybe cut this story and go, that this book is not a book without this story, and you get, so
we need this
hard
story.
Yeah, killing your darlings, that kind of stuff is hard. Yeah.
Now the book ends, and I'm glad you mentioned Usain Bolt crossing the finish line, because the book doesn't end with you crossing, you know, raising your arms, you just finished a race. It ends with fatherhood. So tell me the joys of fatherhood. Congratulations, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, it's ambitious. Going to every country in the world is ambitious. It's beyond most people's reach.
Yes.
Actually, you go around the world, you'll find a lot of cultures probably just wouldn't allow it. Like you wouldn't allow yourself to do it because you feel that you have a responsibility to your family, to your cousins, to your brothers and sisters, and that kind of stuff. So I guess those people, they. You can root out a lot of the world, which is not going to go to every country. Well, doing it in one go, not returning home in between, not flying, that's insanely
That's
ambitious.
Bonkers, bonkers.
And if I knew what I set out to do, I probably wouldn't have left home. You know, it's very, very ambitious. And then, so I thought it was going to take 4 years or less. And I left when I was 34, so I would be back when I was 38. And my wife today, who was my girlfriend back then, she is younger than me. So I figured, okay, we'll be fine. You know, I'll be back in 4 years' time. We'll start a family, because that was on my wish list. And then I suddenly saw this is not a 4-year project. It's a 5-year project, and then 5.5 years and 6 years and then 7. And you get to a global pandemic, and I was bogged down in Hong Kong I didn't know how long. Right. So it's a global pandemic. When is stuff going to move? And everyone's going, well, the world has to move on, and there will be vaccines and people will take them, and and everything will be fine. And, you know, anti-vaxxers wasn't really a thing in the beginning of the pandemic. We're all in the same boat kind of atmosphere. We'll work it out. And then it's 1 month, 2 months, 6 months, 1 year. And you start wondering, what's more important? Is it crossing the finish line in a project which may or may not have any real relevance or meaning to most people, certainly? Or going home and increasing your chances of starting a family. Still no guarantee that you would be able to start a family, but certainly increasing those chances. And that kind of thoughts will just drive you insane. So I stuck it out in Hong Kong, which ended up being 2 years bogged down in Hong Kong with 9 countries left. And then still heading out into the Pacific during the pandemic with these tiny island nations still being closed, having their borders closed due to the pandemic and the risk of containing this virus, and negotiating with governments and successfully on 4 accounts. And then finally, a couple of years later, you know, coming back home and then basically trying to start a family and then kind of accepting maybe we did cross that invisible line somewhere, or maybe it is too late, biology decides. And then one day it was just there, you know, my wife is calling me and I come running. I thought she broke something. and she shows me that stick and goes like, there are 2 more lying there, and go like, this, this is where we're at. Is this still what we want? Wow. And then at our age, you worry like crazy. You mm-hmm. get all the statistics and you go, you know, is this child going to be born with five eyes and three fingers and, you know, what's autism and many other things? Because the risk is just increased dramatically. And then she came into this world over 3 days. She didn't want to come out. So over the course of 3 days, she finally came into the world with 10 fingers and 10 toes and two eyes and a little smile. And she's 9.5 months old now and perfect as far as I can tell.
Amazing, bro. Congratulations, Dad.
Yeah, thank you.
I hate to ask the generic question, but I have to ask, obviously, because I'm having on a famous traveler. What made you a traveler? Because you were a businessman traveler, and then it was Bangkok, right? Southeast Asia got you?
Yeah, I'd say so. Really naive.
It gets us all, man. It gets the Philippines is the one that got me. It was my fourth country, and it changed me. It got me. So how'd Bangkok change you?
There is something to Southeast Asia, isn't there?
Yep.
I think it's like... If you look around the world, it's easy travel. You know, it's kind people. You find kind people all around the world, but there's something in the culture that a lot of people are smiling. They're very helpful. They're soft spoken. Thailand, especially, is like kind of a playground for travel. You know, it's everything you want, whenever you want it, wherever you want it. You know, if you need a tuk-tuk, you raise your arm and five tuk-tuks will come. You know, if you're hungry, you raise your arm and they'll all come with some. It's easy. It's relatively safe. And it's completely different to where I grew up and basically anything else I'd seen before, which sounds a little strange because I'd been to a ton of countries. I'd worked in Libya, in Northern Africa. I was a UN peacekeeper, the Horn of Africa. I grew up partly in the US and in Canada and traveled extensively in Europe, but I hadn't been to Southeast Asia. And it was on a whim that I ended up going there. And again, being very naive, which seems to, I realize now that might be kind of a trend in my life, set out on things being very naive. I was overwhelmed and had some beautiful, beautiful experiences with the culture and with people and some eye-opening encounters also about foreigners in foreign countries. Yeah.
Oh my God. Now, how'd you get to become a UN peacekeeper and then Libya and then Bangkok, let me be a traveler? Fill in those blanks for me.
Yeah, okay. So my father is a businessman and I looked up to my father and I figured, well, it's business school for me. And I did that. And then when I was around 17, the military calls on all young and able men in Denmark to come and draw a number, basically. So they check your physique and your mental capacity, whatever. They do an IQ test and kind of find out if you're smart enough or dumb enough to be in the military, whatever it is. And then you draw a number. And if the number is low, you go to the military. And if the number is high, you can go home or you can volunteer. And I picked a really low number. And that didn't follow suit with my plans of business school and going out and becoming a businessman. But yeah, low number. Then I did military service for 1 year in Denmark, which was back then the longest period you could do. I thought, if you're going to do it, might as well do it. And then that year kind of brainwashed me a little bit. I got so used to people telling me when to get up and what to eat and how many push-ups and what to wear and where to dig. And, you know, it's easy life, you know, the same uniform pretty much every day. And when we came to the last day and we were in civilian clothing and everyone was there in civilian clothing and the parents were there and girlfriends were there and this kind of stuff. Nobody was there. I hadn't told my parents to come or anyone to come. So I was just there alone on a lawn. And everyone has plans. They're going, you know, university or starting a job or traveling for a year. And I was just completely empty-headed. I had no idea, like, waiting for someone to tell me what's next. And a recruitment officer comes over and sees the confusion on my face, I'm sure, and says, can I see your paperwork? And I gave him my, and I had an excellent paperwork because I did exactly what the military wanted from me. So excellent paperwork. And he was like, oh, do you want to come to my office and talk about your future? And I'm like, sure. And 45 minutes later, I signed a contract and I came back. This was a Friday. I came back again Monday. They gave me a new uniform and a blue beret, and then they started training me. And yeah, I went on this mission, which was United Nations mission in Eritrea and Ethiopia.
Wow.
And it was a peacekeeping mission to keep those two countries from starting to fight again. And that was 6 months, 7 months in total, with some R&R and that kind of stuff. And came back and then still wanted to... business, shipping was my plan, shipping, logistics, but there were no jobs. I had to become an apprentice, and I couldn't get an apprenticeship right away. So I went and became a ski instructor in Austria as a placeholder kind of thing, and had fun doing that. And then eventually I became a shipping apprentice, and I did that for 2 years, and then they hired me, and I did that for another, what was it, 10 years, something like that, when I found out that no one had gone to every country in the world completely without flying. But if we just step back a little bit. So
yeah, I'd love to.
The first 4 years of my shipping was in an office in Copenhagen, and that was not what I thought. You know, I wanted to get into shipping because someone told me it's a fast-paced kind of life. You never, no 2 days look the same. Lots of money, international, and this kind of stuff. Now, there wasn't a lot of money. The only thing that was international was the paperwork I was pushing. and no 2 days looked the same. I don't know about that. I think a lot of those days kind of looked the same. So I was, you know, 4 years in, I was going like, I don't know if this is for me. This is not what I wanted to go and work somewhere. I wanted to be an expat. I wanted to go and see the world. And there was a change between office management. So the guy who hired me 4 years earlier, he took his leave, and someone far more experienced came in. It was like a growth kind of thing for the company. And everyone had to come and meet him. And when I met him, I went like, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. I thought I would be in Tokyo or London or New York or something. And he went, oh, you wanna go? And I went, hasn't there been a handover? Didn't you already, like, don't you know I want to go? I said, no, we can work something out. And 3 months later, they sent me to Libya.
Wow.
It wasn't really my Kuala Lumpur moment.
Yeah.
More like, yeah, Gaddafi times. And that was great. I mean, if I hadn't had that project in Libya, if they didn't give me that assignment, I wouldn't have grown into the person I needed to be to go and do a lot of other things that then developed me into being the person that would set out in 2013.
Setting out to see every country. There aren't many of us weirdos out there. There's really not. I think if you ask AI, the numbers are around 400, 450 that visit every country.
Yeah.
And mostly everyone gets celebrated. You know, there'll be an article, some celebrated more than others. You know, we know the travel community of who gets traveled more. You don't seem like you're like a clout chaser or a social media guy. This doesn't seem like you. Why go out to set the record? Was it more of a personal thing? Because it doesn't seem like you're the guy who went out there to... Guys, I'm doing it the fastest, the youngest. Doing it without flying is a weird one, and that doesn't seem like your personality. What made you want to do this project?
There are a lot of answers to that question, and some of them are a bit more honest than others. Adventure, for sure. You know, I grew up with Indiana Jones, and I thought all that stuff was amazing, and I was looking for it in our local forests, which... there weren't many skulls and that kind of stuff, but adventure, yeah. And I did, when I went to Southeast Asia, I ended up going to Cambodia and went to Angkor Wat.
Oh.
You know, I just felt it in my bones. I went like, oh, this is good. You know, there's adventure out there, and that's really touristy adventure still. So that's a part of it. In 2013, I came across that no one had accomplished going to every country completely without flying. I know that people had tried. One guy came really close. but no one had accomplished doing it. And for one reason or the other, it seemed so incredibly important to me that that had to be done. And if I wasn't going to do it, someone else would do it, and then I would regret reading about it someday. And this is 2013. This was, you know, iPhone 5 was the newest iPhone back then, and you know, different president, and lots of stuff. But about 200 people had been to every country in the world, and some people were doing really well on Facebook back then. You know, TikTok wasn't a thing. Instagram was kind of new. The world had just received 3G internet, so we transitioned from 2G to 3G. It wasn't video-based as much as it is today. You went to YouTube if you wanted to see videos, and not so much Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, I guess there was an element of if I do something which no one has ever done before, I could have one of these big accounts, and I could get some sense of fame. So I guess there was some of that. But overall, when I left home, I had the feeling that I wasn't going to use it for anything. That I would go out, I would obviously complete it. Like, what? Why wouldn't I? And I would be the first in history to reach every country in the world completely without flying. Now, thinking I grew up in a time where everything had been done, all these great achievements, the highest mountain, go around the globe, go to the moon, all this stuff was in the past. There's nothing left. But here was an opportunity to do something which had never been done. That has to be useful in one way or the other. But I thought I would come back home and continue doing shipping and logistics. And then and this is the other part. This is maybe the more honest answer, because in 2013, I realized that when my father was born, and my father's 77 now. So when my father was born, there were about 3 billion people on the planet. And today we're 8 billion people, and in 2013, a little bit less. So I saw this trend that we're so many more people on this planet. And I also saw that you have these huge markets in India and China and elsewhere where people are getting educated, and these middle-class groups are growing. And these are smart people. These are well-educated people. So, and it's getting easier to travel. So you'll see someone from South Korea starting up a factory in the US, and then and getting pushed out of the country more recently, but that's not a part of my story. So people they can work anywhere around the world. The companies will set it up, right? There will be apartments, salaries, they'll do the paperwork, they have agencies to take care of this. So I realized, you know, someday I will be replaced by someone who is willing to work for less money than me, speaks more languages than me, is far smarter than me, and works harder than me, you know, delivers a better result than me, at which point there are no more logistics jobs for me. They won't be sending me to Libya or Bangladesh. They'll be sending Jimmy or whoever from somewhere else around the world. And then I figured I will be out of a job. And this was pre-AI, you know. Now today you can look at AI and go like, I'll be out of a job.
Yes, very soon. But
back then I was thinking, you know, global growth and the world becoming more international. So I figured, okay, if I have something that nobody else has, if I'm the only person on the planet that has that, then I must be able to spin something out of it. And I figured that storytelling, there will always be, like, storytelling has been a trade for as long as people have walked the face of this planet. So storytelling, if you have compelling stories, if you can tell a story in a compelling way, then you'll never be out of a job. So that was my thought. Then when one day there's no more shipping and logistics for me, then I'll just go into storytelling and drink wine and have a good life. But I'll tell you what changed. So I went to most of Europe, all of North America, Central America, South America, came back to Europe, went into Africa, completed the entirety of Africa, came back to Europe. And I'd done some speaking gigs along the way, where schools had invited me to come and talk about what I was doing. Some companies had invited me to come and talk, a few libraries and so on. So I was kind of building up, you know, experience in standing in front of an audience and telling my story and bringing value and working out what do people want to hear, what do they not want to hear, this kind of stuff. And then I was invited to come to a corporate office in Madrid. And, you know, sometimes I speak in front of an audience and it's good and people are happy, mostly. Sometimes it's less good. Sometimes it's just exceptional. Sometimes I get like an incredible reaction from the audience. So I don't know, maybe the audience, maybe me, maybe the air, I don't know. But this was one of those times in Madrid, you know, nobody left the room. Nobody looked at their phones. Everyone came up to shake my hand. Some people wanted autographs. Everyone wanted selfies. Like, it was crazy. And then I walk out of the office with like an HR manager. And the HR manager says, "That was fantastic. We have speakers come. We haven't had that kind of reaction before. That was absolutely brilliant." And then she said, "We had a guy come who was supposed to motivate the office not long ago. And he spoke for an hour and people were leaving. They were looking at their phone, went to the toilet, didn't come back, this kind of stuff." And there was none of that with me. And then she said how much they paid him. And which, you know, at that point, I think that was about $5,000 or something like that. But so for me, I thought speaking engagements, $200, $400 on a good day. And then she said $5,000. I went, "I'm not going back to shipping. Like, why would I do that? I'm feeling great. They all love me. Everyone wanted a selfie with me and I would get paid for that. That is what I want to do." But then here I am, 2025, and obviously there's competition. I didn't really think about there would also be competition.
two random questions. One, let's clear up a misconception about you. You're not this rich kid who's afraid of flying. Not one bit, right?
No. And it's also not an environmental thing.
Someone else said
which
that.
It's funny because I left in 2013 and I had a few low-level interviews when I left. And nobody asked anything about environment. And then around 2015, maybe 16, I started getting the first interviews from organizations, and they figured, well, this guy's not flying because of the impact flying has on the environment. So they were saying, of course, you're doing this because of the environment. And I had to go, "I have respect for the environment and I see where things are going, but that's not why I'm doing it." And so on. And now in 2025, everyone assumes it's the environment because the world has made this shift. Greta Thunberg, if you're familiar with her.
Of course,
I figured. So she became a thing in 2017, I think, 16 or 17. Nobody had heard about her outside her school, I guess, until 16 or 17. And that changed the world in terms of how we speak about the environment and what it is to protect the environment and care for the environment. And that's interesting to me, how the world has changed in those years. So now people will not even ask why I did it without flying. They'll just assume it was.
They're assuming it. The guy who did it or who almost did it before you, he had a few loopholes. Has he ever reached out to you? Have you ever spoken to him or anything?
Yeah, we spoke a little bit. He's not a great fan.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so, yeah. Not a fan of Thor?
He's not this Thor, at least. he did an incredible thing, and he sacrificed himself to get to what he calls the finish line in his project. And it would have been rough. And he's the closest thing in the world to understand what I actually did. People have gone to every country in the world. They also understand about bureaucracy and this kind of stuff, but this is a different animal, and he has a good grasp on what I went through, but not completely, as he had some loopholes as well.
I always love how on paper all the trips come great. Like, hey, I'm going to the South Pacific. I'm going to go to Hawaii, Marshall Islands, Kiribati, Nauru, 2 days in each country. Flights aren't going to get canceled. Everything's good, and then you get there. Like, why am I so naive? I'll use one of your words. You started off great. You got sponsors, the Red Cross. Like, you started off perfectly. You mapped the whole plan out. It's easier now to do a quick Google search. Hey, how difficult is it to get a visa to Turkmenistan? when you did it early, you really weren't going through 193 or 197, whatever, 195, whatever your number is. You didn't go that way and be like, let me check off every visa. You kind of just started the journey, or did you look at the visa process?
Oh, I did not look at the visas at all. And this is, comes back to the naivety within it. I thought that I would, it would be some sort of Forrest Gump kind of thing, that once people like caught wind of what I was doing, I would just have 70 people behind me, you know, at all times. I pretty much thought that I did not need to film any of this. I've never been a video kind of guy. I always like photos and writing, but I figured I wouldn't have to do any video footage because at some point I would just constantly be surrounded by TV crews and production crews following me, and I can just get that footage. I thought I wouldn't really have to collect evidence of what I was doing because it would just be evident that, of course, I had done this kind of stuff. You know, much later on, I started looking into what the requirements might be with the Guinness World Book and of Guinness World Records. I wasn't living up to it at all. You know, I did not have these stacks of evidence that even today, I think, you know, in certain countries, I would struggle to prove that I didn't fly to get there. I know this is hilarious to me. Probably this will come back and bite me at some point saying this in a podcast. But there are two island nations within the Caribbean that when I arrived on, one with a fishing boat and one with a small freight boat, banana boat kind of thing. And when I arrived to the port, the guys at the port, they went, "Yeah, man, welcome to our island, man." And I go, "Where's immigration? I need to get a stamp in my passport." And go like, no immigration in the port, man. They, you go to the airport. And I go like, "Yeah, but how do, you know, I'm in the country now. How can I just walk freely?" And you go, "Oh, no, relax, man. Welcome to the islands, man." And then I walk for an hour or so and get to the airport and walk in and immigration say, "Which flight?" And say, "No, I came on this ship." And I go, "Yeah, whatever." And then I get a stamp with an airplane.
No, you know,
in my passport. I go, like, "Oh, okay." So I have photos of the ship. I have my experience with the journey. I have emails coordinating, getting on board the ship, this kind of stuff. But if someone says, "Where's the proof?" and they want to look in my passport, says, why were you stamped in at the airport? Then I have to give that story. So I don't know if I can prove that I did what I'm telling everyone that I did.
So you were gone 10 years. I'm pretty sure people know that you didn't take a loophole to one country. Trust me.
One of my friends says the same thing.
Yeah, let's be honest. Now, let me ask you this question. Going through the process, obviously stuff happens, the pandemic and other crazy stuff. What's one thing now that you're looking back on, like, how didn't I plan that doing what was going to happen? When I got your book, the thing I thought about initially was the South Pacific, going from the Solomon Islands to Tonga to Micronesia. For me, I'm like, dude, that would eliminate me right away. What's one thing that now that you laugh at, like, did I really think I was going to be able to do that? Yet you did it. What's one thing that sticks out the most?
Well, I got, you know, essentially I got it all right.
You did.
I did it. And this comes back to a point which a good friend of mine, Mike Douglas, a great name, isn't it? Mike, he tells me that this is not going to happen again. And even I, who has done this, if I was given the chance to do it 100 times over, I would fail 100 times. Yeah. You know, I could lose my life in probably traffic somewhere, or run into someone, some evildoer or whatnot. There would be a ship I couldn't get on, a visa I couldn't get on. I would get deported somewhere. I'd get a tropical disease. I would wear out, give up along the way, as I probably should have a million times. He says, I wouldn't be able to do this again. And in spite of that, the very first time I tried, I did do it. And in part, maybe it's being naive, you know, going like, "Yeah, no, it's got to get better. It's just, I just need to get around the bend, or yeah, I'll find someone who will help me." And I also think I have that kind of face about me where people come up to me and think, "This guy does not know what he's doing. We better help him. We better give him a, lend him a hand here." I'm a member of the Adventurers Club in Denmark, which is pretty cool. It's a members only club, and you can only get in by invitation, and it's a long process. And it starts by giving a talk, and they invited me to come and do a talk, 45 minutes plus 15 minute questions, and then you go and have dinner and beer. And they said, "What do you want to talk about?" And I had identified three stories from three continents where I was all trying to make progress, and that progress only came by chance alone. And so it's the kind of stuff where if you say, "How did you do that?" I can tell you my story, and then we will both recognize that's not going to happen again. So you can't rely on that, and I wouldn't be able to rely on it happening another time. But that kind of stuff is in this project as well. You can plan as crazy as you want, and a lot of it some of it was skill. You know, you can't just. Yeah. Some of it was skill. A lot of it was kindness. I really have a lot of faith in humans, especially having done what I've done and met all the people I have all around the world, that they will be there for you and they will try to help and assist in one way or the other. And someone's just dumb luck. You know, you get on that bus and not that bus, and, you know, one bus crashes and you're in the good bus. You know, this kind of stuff happens. And also just... you meet the right person. I have this one story, which is really long, and we don't have time for it. But the essence of it is I'm at a border, and I need help to go this way, to go, let's say, south. And I meet someone, and that happens to be the person that I need to cross the border. It's a complicated border. I need assistance. I meet that person, but that person is going north. And not only do we meet in that moment, you know, because that guy could have arrived 10 minutes before, I wouldn't have met him, and I could have arrived, you know, something else. I could be looking the other way. So we met at that border. But after 24 hours, he was circling back, coming back to the country again. So I get his details, and it all works out. And it's a good story of chance and luck, especially when it's told in detail. But I think you get the point.
You didn't sugarcoat much in the book. You talked about yachts in Cuba, basically being sick, getting malaria in Central Africa, yeah. Getting thrown out of some countries, which is the scariest thing because, like, we're throwing you out. They're not saying, "Okay, sir, get back on that boat." They're throwing you on a plane to get out of there. So the anxiety during it. Yeah. While you're doing it, are you ever like, "Oh, my God, is anyone else trying this as we speak and can beat me quicker?" Was that ever going through your head at all or no?
Yeah, that was going through my head. And the deeper I got into it, I realized that's probably not the case because it is a very small community. And you have these groups like MTP, Most Traveled People, and mm-hmm. Nomad Mania, and Century Club, or they keep a pretty close eye on people and their movement. And it's hard to do something of that proportion. I mean, if you're going to every country in the world, forget about doing it without flying, but if you're going to every country in the world and you do not pick up any media at any point along the way, then that's almost an achievement. You know, if there's no blogger that writes about you, or it's no, you don't meet anyone at a hostel or a hotel mm-hmm. that tells someone else, then you're James Bond. I mean, So the deeper I got into it, I realized there's nobody who's flying under the radar. You know, there might be competition out there, but you would find out about it sooner or later. But I was worried before leaving home. I was worried. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell many, at least. I didn't really want to do press before leaving home because I thought if someone else hears this, they'll just pack their bag and
leave. That's a great idea. I'm out.
Yeah, I thought that. But we grow older. We grow wiser, hopefully.
You mentioned being stuck in Hong Kong for 2 years, finishing up. Mm. What were your final three countries? You have three left. What three were they left? And was it strategically planned for these three to be your last three? Like, we're both friends with Rick Gazarian, Global Gaz, and he wants his final to be Ireland for celebration. Did you have a list? Like, okay, I want one of these to be my final one, or you didn't care when you mapped it out?
No, there wasn't anything like that. I didn't even recognized that was a thing. You know, Drew Binsky planned Saudi Arabia to be his last one. And apparently it's because of the click rate, or how much money you get on YouTube per click rate is much higher in Saudi Arabia. So, and he's a big YouTuber. So
yes.
You go that way. My last three were Tuvalu in the Pacific, and then two in the Indian Ocean. There was Sri Lanka and Maldives. And this was logistics more than anything, not so much Tuvalu. The Pacific happened to become harder than what it had to be due to the pandemic.
Yes.
And then suddenly, it wasn't my choice anymore. You know, whichever country opened and which order they opened and whichever country I could negotiate my way to. So the third last, Tuvalu, was kind of a coincidence. When I planned the project, the last four would have been New Zealand, Australia, Sri Lanka, Maldives, and then go back to Denmark. And if you envision a map and you look at that, that's kind of a straight line going back home to Denmark. So that was the logistics of making my way home. And the Pacific was always towards the end of the project because I knew great distances and no ferries. You couldn't just buy a ticket and show up. You know, you need to rely on people that can bring you to these islands. You might have complications with immigration. As it turns out, a lot of immigration is not just concerned about who they let in. They're also very concerned about if they leave again. And if you come to an island, then that's a different beast than going to a landlocked country. Because with a landlocked country, you can just, like, how are you going to the next country? Well, I'll go to the border and cross and go, like, yeah, that's fine. Welcome to our country. But you go to an island, they go, like, how are you leaving? We see you don't have a flight.
Where's your outbound flight?
Yeah. Where's you? How are you going? And go, like, I'll find a way. And so how do we know that you don't want to settle in our beautiful island nation? And you're like, well, you know, and you can't offend them. You can't go because my country's better than yours. I don't want to live here. You can't say that. I go, like, no, you have I see your point. I see most people would probably want to travel through 150 countries overland over the last 7 years to come and settle in your country. So the Pacific towards the end, because there are all sorts of obstacles there. And I figured if it's towards the end, you'll have more support. You'll have a larger social media following. You'll get better coverage in terms of media, and you'll get the help you need. Opposed to if you start with that, no one's willing to help, or not many would be willing to help in the beginning.
What changed the most about you? Not being a father, not you being a husband. What changed the most with you in year one and year 10? Like, oh my God, I was that dude, or look who I became. What changed the most that you can recognize in yourself?
Age, life experience, and not in the traditional sense, or I guess. So I'll try to explain. On and off, you'll meet someone who's 40 years old, and then you go, like, I can't believe it. You're acting like you're 20. You know, someone who just hasn't reached that maturity in life. Maybe they partied far more than everyone else. Maybe they didn't read the right books, and maybe they watch the wrong things on Netflix, who knows? But they seem very young compared to being 40. You could also see that someone who's 60, who just doesn't seem to have the maturity and the wisdom you would expect with someone who's 60. And you'll see it the other way around. Sometimes you'll come across someone who's 25 and you go, like, my goodness, the depth in you. Like, how on earth do you have the knowledge and the wisdom at 25? You seem to have such an old spirit. This is the kind of stuff we say, right? So with that in mind, you may assume that there's a highway to gaining life experience, that some people will gain it faster than other people, and what might be the case there. And then I put a lot of thought into this. So I figure whenever we are challenged, that's when we're on the highway of life experience. So if you're going through a divorce, or you lose a job, or you lose someone you care dearly for, or you get sick, or, you know, something, some hardship is thrown in your direction, then you're aging at lightning speed. And you'll see this with people who live in the slum. You'll see this with many different situations, you know, a natural disaster or armed conflict will also age people rapidly. So maybe they lose out somewhere else, but they grow old real fast. And where are you constantly challenged? So I think it's challenged. Whenever you're challenged, you're gaining life experience. So where are you constantly challenged? Well, you're challenged when you're taken out of your environment. And no more so is true than going to a foreign country where people speak a different language, they have different customs, different smells, different history, different background, all this stuff. You need to work stuff out constantly. The simple stuff, like how do I get a SIM card? How do I activate it? You know, did I bring the right plugs? What should I take a bus? Should I take this bus or that bus? Should I go by train? What are my options here? You're learning everything from the bottom. And for the better part of 10 years, I was challenged and sometimes tremendously challenged. So I wonder if I've been on the highway of life experience for a very, very long time, a big portion of my life, and that instead of being, I'm almost 47 according to my passport, but how old am I really in terms of life experience? And that is the biggest difference between 2013 and today.
What a great answer. Did you enjoy, not the journey, that's silly to say. I'll tell you what I struggle with. I get obsessed with the country. So for like 3 years, it was Turkmenistan. And because of my job, I couldn't get there. I had to find the same way you did. If someone calls me up and people do like, hey, how'd you get to Turkmenistan? I can't tell them how, it wasn't shady. I can't tell them how I got there, how I became friends with this one, because it just happens by chance. I'm like, oh my God. Yet I was obsessed with going there. I go there, loved it. Then I come home, now I'm obsessed with Iran, and I'm planning to go to Iran in December. But now I'm obsessed now with Sudan. And so I find myself always looking to see what's next. Did you enjoy, like, hey, I'm in maybe early on, I'm in Germany, let me hang out, and you know, I'll be generic, have some beer. I'll go to Cambodia, see Angkor Wat. Like, did you have a problem enjoying the ride as it was happening?
Yeah, it was difficult because it was a very full project. I was running social media, but not as someone who has 50 friends on social media and you're sharing whatever you feel like and get a reaction. You know, I was trying to promote these countries. I was trying to promote the Red Cross. I was trying to get in touch with the Red Cross in these individual countries. I traveled as a goodwill ambassador of the Danish Red Cross with an aim to promote the humanitarian work that is being carried out across the world, raising funds, raising awareness, and also symbolically connecting the Red Cross throughout the entire world. So I would have to find out who am I getting in touch with at the German Red Cross and get a response out of them and set up a date and get an address and show up and then go through death by PowerPoint again and again and again and learn what are they doing, what's unique about the Red Cross in Germany compared to Iceland, compared to Uganda, and so on, and find the story that I could share on social media. Relatively unsuccessfully, it never caught on, but I ended up doing it in 199 countries out of my 203 was my number. So that was time consuming. Of course, I also needed to work out where am I sleeping tonight? Mm-hmm. Which transportation am I leaving with tomorrow? And this is the thing, if you haven't planned it out before you go home, and I'm not even sure you could do that for such a long project. Because I'd have to say there were some ferries that I counted on when I left in 2013 to connect me to some islands or connect me elsewhere. And when I showed up 2 or 3 years later, they had discontinued service and airplanes had taken over. So some things you can really not plan for. But we show up somewhere and you're in this city and you need to go across the border and go to that city. What are your options and what are your best options? You know, if the price difference between a train and a bus is $1, then that might not matter, you know. But if the price difference is $50, it certainly matters in a $20 per day budget. And also, You have the chicken bus and the luxury bus, the VIP bus, right? And the VIP bus has glass pane windows and aircon and comfortable seats, and someone cleans the bus and it doesn't stop everywhere. And maybe there's Wi-Fi, and it takes 4 hours, and the chicken bus takes 12 hours and stops everywhere, and this kind of stuff. So you need to work all of that out. And in between all of that, you're meeting people because you're trying. How are you going to promote a country if you don't understand the country? So maybe I pop into a local museum and try to get like a background, or maybe I read their Wikipedia page. I've done that sometimes. Or talk to people. Sometimes you gain perspective of a country by speaking to someone for 1 hour, more perspective than you get from living in that country for a month or being in that country for a month. So all of that had to fall into place. Of course, you need to eat, need to get the visas, need to get the, in some parts of the world, travel permits and invitation letters and this kind of stuff. So very quickly, it went from being 99% adventure and 1% work to the opposite, right? So it's 99% work. It's 99% repetition. Okay, you got to do this again. You got to do this. You have to prep this. On top of that, I was trying to get a photo of a local person's eyes in every country around the world. So look for someone. And, you know, I was in Ireland and the first seven people I asked weren't even Irish. So you just keep going through people. Like, how are there no Irish people in this country? And then and I felt so embarrassed by asking complete strangers if I could take a picture of their eyes in the beginning. 100 countries down the line, you're just grabbing people and taking a shot of their eyes. I would take a picture of the sunset in every country around the world, and sort of to have, this is something everyone has. We all have sunsets, until you're in a country where it's been raining for a week and you don't know which direction the sun is in. And my feet, I was filming my feet. I had this idea of my feet just walking, and then you'd edit it all together. But then it was kind of crappy to begin with, and then you realize it's too much. And you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be able to distinguish your feet walking in this country or that country anyway. So it wasn't a great idea, but spending time doing that. I picked up a gift in one country and brought it to the next. And then I picked up a gift there and brought it to the next. And this also to connect like this. So tons of stuff was going on. So I hardly had time to breathe, especially in the beginning when, borders were open. I was traveling in Europe. Borders are open. Transport is available. Just get all this stuff done and go, 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 go. And then it slowed down when I couldn't get a visa, or when I was waiting for a visa. You know, maybe I know I'm getting my visa on Thursday. It's Monday. Okay, that means, I can go through my emails today. I can do a little bit of this. And then I have maybe Wednesday I can go out and climb this mountain or go to a waterfall or something else.
I remember, I think it was like 9 years ago, me and Lee Abamonte having beers in a bar in New York with podcasting. I think I had I was at that time, I was at 9 or 10 countries. I knew nothing about probably 100 and something of them. I didn't even know how many countries there were. You would have told me 20 or 2,000, I wouldn't have known. And he comes on, he's like, oh, I went to every country in the world. I'm like, I'm going to do that. He's like, don't. It's a horrible decision. And this is a true story. I think after like 10 beers, I'm like, I'm doing it. He's like, bro, you're going to regret it. And now I'm in the journey. I'm regretting doing this. Has anyone reached out to you and said, hey, I want to try to do this without flying? Yeah. And then what do you tell them? What do you tell them?
Yeah, well, I tell them. Well, you don't want to discourage people, but you... I come back to, there's a big difference between success and the road to success, you know? And if people see me as successful because I have a bit of a following on social media and because I've done what I've done, then fine. But, you know, no one's interested in, they just assume it's wonderful. They just assume you wake up every day and these birds fly in and take, to bring you up and bring you your clothes. And a robot drone comes in and shoves breakfast in your mouth and you walk down the street and people are throwing money at you. I don't know what people assume. It's regular life, you know. I changed my baby's diapers several times a day. I take the trash out. I get rejected all day long, you know. But I do speaking engagements. I make a living out of that. But for every one speaking engagement I do, I've been rejected by 20 who said, we don't want to hear from a guy who's been to every country in the world. Why did you even do that? You know, so there's the people, they see the positives. That's in my project. You know, I couldn't, you know, I needed to get on a ship to go to an island. Again, you ask 10 shipping companies, and most of them never reply. Some of them do and say no. Some of them make up excuses. Some of them might have valid excuses. And then one brings you. So if I did 9 posts going like, this company said no, this company said no, da, 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 that's not what you do. You know, you risk the next time you're asking, they will say no because you badmouth companies. So you don't do that. Mm-hmm. The one company that takes you on board, you put on a big, brave smile. You do your best selfie and go like, look, I'm on the ship. And then people on social media, ah, that's amazing. I want to travel on a container ship. I wish it was me. Oh, you're living the dream. You're living my life and this kind of stuff. So you give people I gave them a reality of the journey, but a very positive reality, which involved meeting people, eating exotic food, and successes. You know, I got this visa, I crossed this border, I got on this ship, you know, success, success, success. But, you know, I didn't cover the hours and hours and hours that went into it. So in some way, and I know this, I kind of went off on a path there, but some way I have to explain that to someone who says, I want your life. I'm going, no, you don't. Yes, yes, I want your life. No, trust me, you don't want my life. I want to do what you have done. And so, well, okay. But you could set yourself a smaller goal. See if you can reach 50 countries without flying. And if you like that, then maybe go to 100. And if you like that, to sit at home and go like, I'm going to do it all. Just going to go to all. And, you know, every week now, I'm in several WhatsApp groups with 193ers, which is the official number. 193 is what United Nations gives you. That's how many countries there are in the world when you cut it to the bone. So 193ers, and there's a new 193er every week. You know, there's the uniqueness of, hey, have you heard this guy or this woman has been to every country in the world? It's like, yeah, it's like Everest. You look at Mount Everest and you see there's this queue.
That line, yeah.
That line going all the way down, you go like, why are they doing it? You know, it was done in 1953. That was pretty special. It might have been special in the 60s and 70s, but at some point in the 80s or 90s, it's not that magical anymore. But you don't want to remove people's hopes. And then obviously you also want to hear from people that they're doing it for the right reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, why do you want to? Because I want to be a big YouTuber. And like, well, okay, well, maybe. Okay, good luck.
Yeah.
But if they say, I want to meet people, you know, this is my passion. I just want to go out and talk to people. I have this deep belief that what I see in the evening news is skewing the actual picture of what the world is like. And you can parachute me into any country around the world, and I will meet nice and decent people that are all about family life and their careers and TikTok dances and Netflix and, you know, food and barbecues and dancing and this kind of stuff. And that is true. You know, you will find so much of that. And if that is why people, they want to do it, then who cares if they cross the finish line? Just let them go out and have as much as that as they can possibly carry.
We've been talking the whole time about the book. I want to talk very, very briefly about the documentary. Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
You were kind enough to send it to me. It's been the hardest thing I haven't done. I haven't watched it because I wanted to wait till after I interviewed you, because I wanted to talk about the book and that journey. I feel the documentary will skew it because I'm watching stuff and stuff. So I'm so happy I'm interviewing tonight because my wife has been, hey, when are we watching? I'm like, after I podcast. What's going on? What's the process with that? Can people help? Where can we see it? Give me some thoughts about it. How many countries left when you started? So talk about the documentary and stuff.
Yeah, the documentary came about because in 2013, 3 days before I left home, I needed a pair of shoes. And I walked into a store and said, give me something that can take it. You know, I'm going everywhere. I need, if it's hot, if it's cold, if it's wet, if it's dry. And I think this guy didn't really care. He just pulled down a pair of shoes. And it happened to be Salomon. A pair of Salomon, really sturdy footwear. So that was good. And I left in that, and when I wore those down, I reached out to Salomon and said, look at me, and I never heard from them. And then I bought a new pair, And I continued in Salomon thinking, if I keep doing this, eventually I'll catch their eye. And 170 countries in, I finally caught their attention. And they sent me a new pair of shoes. And then after a while, they came back to me and they went, you know, we have a YouTube channel and we feature our athletes. And we think you have an interesting story. So can we please connect you with a filmmaker? And then we'll do like a 12-minute thing about your journey. And it will end up on our YouTube channel and probably get 500,000 views, something like that. Okay. And I was... Absolutely, you know.
Hell yeah, sign me up.
Yes, I've been dreaming about this. Put me shoulder by shoulder next to your top athletes and put me on your YouTube channel and let 500,000 people hear my story. Absolutely. And they connected me with Mike Douglas, the guy I mentioned earlier on. Mm-hmm. And he ended up flying out, meeting with me in Marshall Islands, which is also in my book. I have a great story from Marshall Islands. I think I love it. So he came and he interviewed me for a few days and then he came back to Salomon and said, this is not 12 minutes. We can't do this in 12 minutes. This is a bigger thing. And then they gave him the license to go ahead Wow. and develop that. And they pumped more money into it. And then eventually he came out to visit 4 times in total. So he came out the first time in 2019. And then we had the entire pandemic where everything was put on hold. And then he came out sometime after the pandemic, 3 times more, and was on the final ship that brought me to the final country. And yeah, so that was great. And then he went back to Canada where he lives and he edited it all together. And it came out to be 1 hour, 43 minutes. And it's fantastic. This is what people like. I'd love your take on it. But people, they love it. People, they say the score is great, the way it's been edited, the story. It's also very honest. I said it's really, really well done. And then we're like, yeah, of course, that's going on Netflix. And we spoke to Netflix, and Netflix went like, yeah, we've got a lot of stuff. And Netflix original said the same. And you talk to Disney and you talk to all the big streaming, you know, Nat Geo. Well, we have another story about someone who every country in the world, so you know it's kind of too much of the same. And then you kind of go through the list, and then you go to film festivals and you go, well, we some film festival, and you go to all the A-list film festivals, and we got turned down by all the A-list film festivals one by one. And it all comes down to that one person watches the film, right? Let's say you watch this tonight mm-hmm. and you do not like it, right? But, you know, everybody else, they liked it. But for some reason, it doesn't sit well with you. And then you go and sit around a table with 20 other people, and then you have to talk about which movies you watched and which movies are going on the film festival or which is going on the streaming platform. And it's just your opinion, and mm-hmm. you're a respectable guy, and I like you, and maybe you're right and everyone else is wrong. But this is kind of the fault in the system here. Like, you've got one shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, then that's it. Yeah, so that's where it's at today. The film is there on a shelf waiting for someone to buy it. And it is a good story. And some of the best feedback I've had from the very few people that have had a chance to watch this film, where I got some feedback, was that they're busy schedule. They didn't really have time to watch it. They were going to do it. They were going to watch half an hour tonight and then maybe the rest tomorrow, this kind of stuff. And then the next day they get back to me and went like, yeah, I was going to do that. Watch half an hour. But then I just got sucked in and I went to bed late. And that's the storytelling is amazing. And all of that is Mike Douglas. You know, I'm just the guy that the cameras were pointing at, you know, he worked magic. But he really worked magic, and that it is, I'm biased. I'm in the film. I had to watch it a few times to sort of like see the film and not just see myself. But I think it's a good film. People I talk to think it's a good film. I haven't had anyone come back and go like, no, I kind of fell asleep. Like no one at all. So it'll be interesting to have your take on it. The answer to your question is, it's a tough market.
Yeah.
The pandemic happened, apparently, and everyone was streaming for a couple of years. And because of that, there was an overproduction. So there's plenty of stuff that has been produced, which hasn't been featured yet. And then during the pandemic, new streaming platforms popped up, mm-hmm. and you had all this variety. But today, a lot of them have been bought up by others. So they're actually quite few that you can reach out to. And if they go no, it's like, okay, then there's nowhere else to go.
I will be dead honest because my wife and I will be watching it tonight. So tomorrow morning, you'll have a text message for me. Yeah. The book is The Impossible Journey, an incredible voyage through every country in the world without flying. Thor, I'm going to be honest with you. I read a book a week. That's always my goal. One of my favorite books I've read in such a long time. And it has nothing to do with my passion of traveling. It was the way you told it as such a good human, as such a good person. I've had you for 70 minutes. Are you ready to finish up with a couple of quick hit questions?
Yeah, shoot. As you might have recognized, I don't give short answers.
I love it, though. Here we go.
Try it.
Last show you binged watched.
Westworld.
Favorite late night snack?
Chocolate.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting one. Generic travel question. I hate it. Most underrated country. Someone's like, Thor, you've been to the mall, bro. Give me a couple of underrated countries I need to visit.
I go Libya. Ooh. I mean, Libya has a lot going for it. I can just Libya. Yeah.
Oh, what? Very short answer. I like it. How about this one? I have many athletes on my show, and I always ask them the coolest person in their phone. So, Thor, you're in New York. You and I are at a bar. No one cares that we travel. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back and impress people in the bar? You got anyone cool in your phone?
I have some, like, I would hate to lose my phone. I've made some high-ranking contacts throughout. Years later, would they still reply to me? There is... I won't tell. But yeah, there are some.
Very, very, very fair. When you finish your journey, what's the first country you're like, I want to go there on vacation? I don't want to rush through it. What's the first country that you're like, hey, I want to go back there. I want to go on vacation there.
Well, the first country I did go to was Finland because my mother lives there.
Okay.
Country I would love to vacation in, I'd love to go back to Hong Kong, which is technically not a country. But I have friends in Hong Kong. I had a life in Hong Kong. I miss Hong Kong. If you go apart from that, maybe Japan. Japan is not made for a $20 per day budget. And Japan looks amazing. I just need money.
Yeah. So when are you coming to New York City so we can hang out? Do you have any plans to come to the Big Apple?
As soon as possible. You know, I'd love to get a publisher in the U.S., and then I would love to do a book tour in the U.S.
Oh, you know, yeah.
If I could get some kind of representation, some agent in the U.S., big or small, but someone who could set up that I would go to universities or go to different bookstores or whatever, I would be on a plane very, very quickly. I would just jet across the pond and come and say hi.
Now plug the book, the website, the Instagram before we say goodbye, my friends.
Okay. Well, there is no book like this in the world because no one has gone to every country in the world in one unbroken journey complete without flying. And that book is my story of what that was like, what it took from me and what it gave me. And judging by most people, it came out all right. So that's the book. The film, I mean, it's the kind of film that people get sucked into. People, they want to watch it to the end. They don't want to run to the toilet. So that's what it is. And what am I plugging? What more am I plugging?
Plug your Instagram so everybody can follow you and follow your journey and your beautiful family.
Come and follow my Instagram because I am the worst social media content creator on the planet. And you can judge me day in and day out. And years from now, you can scratch the back of your head and wonder why on earth you're still following me.
Thor, this was an absolute pleasure. I'm going to watch a documentary tonight, so expect a call from me tomorrow. Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thor, I enjoyed this. Thank you so much, Mike.
Have a great day, my friend.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.